The Talking Stigma podcast feature Garrett Thomas and me, Craig Doyle, talking to other well-known guests about stigma and how we can make stigma a thing of the past through knowledge and education. Listen to Garrett talking about his HIV positive diagnosis, how people have treated him, how he has felt since he announced his status back in September 2019, and how through scientific advances, being on effective treatment means the levels of HIV are so low in his system that the virus cannot be passed on through sexual contact. The intimate discussions draw on personal insights of Garrett and other special guests, comparing and contrasting their experiences of stigma. Hello all, you're very welcome to Tackle HIV with Garrett Thomas and the Talking Stigma podcast series. I'm Craig Doyle, and throughout this series I'm talking to Gareth and other well-known guests about stigma and resilience. What's it like to be discriminated against, to suffer prejudice, to be stigmatised? How does it feel? What do you do about it? Do people support you? What can you do to get people to support you? These are all the subjects and all the topics we've been discussing throughout this series with some really, really interesting results. And that continues today. A really, really good guest coming your way in today's podcast, who I introduce in just a moment. First of all, though, Garrett Thomas, how are you?
Top of the morning.
I don't know any Welsh. I only know the Welsh word diach, right? Is there a Welsh? What do Welsh
people? Weddol is all right. Weddol.
Where?
Weddol.
I'm not saying that. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Come here, you look kind of well for like everyone else looks stressed out from lockdown. You're looking like it's all right.
Mate, I've made the effort today. It's the only time in 12 months that I've had the opportunity to put something on apart from a tracksuit. So I thought I'll go for it today. I'll make an effort.
Do you remember one of the first times we worked together, Rugby World Cup, and we were based in London before we went to New Zealand, and we were doing a game that kicked off at 4 o'clock in the morning. And you arrived into the studios in ITV at 3 o'clock in the morning, stinking of brandy and awful aftershave, right? And you had a basketball shirt on and a pair of shorts and boots. Do you remember? And you just come straight from a club or something.
I had the stamp for the nightclub on my hand. It was on television and my mother was texting me saying, wash your hands, because I had stamps from all the nightclubs I'd been in London on my arm.
Oh, nightclubs, good old days, pubs, eh? We have a really good guest, so I think we should introduce them straight away. Because we're kind of getting to the very core of what this whole podcast series is about with our guest today. So allow me introduce him. He is Nathaniel Hall, an actor and theatre maker who most recently starred as Donald Bassett in Channel 4's It's a Sin, the brilliant It's a Sin. It's a really powerful show if you haven't seen it. And it depicts the lives of a group of gay men and their friends. And I'm highlighting friends because actually one of the real striking points of it is the friendships for me when I watched it. They live together during the 80s, just as the HIV epidemic starts to unfold. And I guess there was a lot of ignorance at the time. And when you look back at some of the stuff in the series, it really is shocking. We're going to be discussing that. Like Garrett, though, Nathaniel is HIV positive and is prominent in his activism to help tackle the stigma and misunderstanding around HIV. He's written and performed his award-winning one-man show, First Time, an autobiographical show about attempting to stay positive in a negative world. He's a very interesting guy, and I'm delighted to say he joins us now. Nathaniel, how are you?
That's a round of applause.
Let's do that.
Not often we give a round of applause.
Thanks very much. I'm great. I'm feeling surprisingly fresh. I had real lockdown fatigue at the start of this week, but this knowing this interview has just perked me right up at the end on this Friday. So yeah, I'm feeling great.
Shall we do wallpaper plants, that kind of thing first before we get into the meat and veg of the conversation? Do you want to go in the interior design?
All I can say is we've done a lot of Zooms and Nathaniel's background is out of 10, I'd give it a strong 15.
15.
It's nailing it.
Do you know what? There's actually an account, an Instagram account for Zoom backgrounds, but I don't think mine has made it onto it yet. I think it's more bookcases they're looking for. But I know Russell T Davies, the writer of It's a Sin, his bookcase background has made it onto that Instagram account because it is absolutely incredible. It's like he's sat in a library, but it's actually his own bookcase.
I am on that account. I like your framing. You'd know that you're a man of theatre and film. The framing's absolutely perfect. It's a Sin has been a huge success in many ways, not just because people have enjoyed the drama of it all, but it started some really important conversations, Nathaniel. Give everyone an idea what the show's all about.
Yeah, so the show is about, I guess, a part of history that we haven't seen explored in this kind of depth on British television yet. You know, HIV and AIDS as the epidemic, you know, the last 40 years, it has been dealt with. We have seen it in a number of big plays, you know, Angels in America, The Normal Heart by Larry Kramer. We've seen some American films about it and some European films, but we've not really had something on British telly that really looks at that moment in history. And for the most part, in terms of the UK's sort of response to HIV, it's quite a shameful part of our history. So it's been amazing because this month is LGBT History Month, and it's been incredible to see that story, those stories, those lives sort of honoured and validated in such a great way. So the show, like you said, follows you know, a group of young friends, some of whom are gay, who all move. It's the small town boy story, you know. So they all move from various small towns and areas of the UK to London, the bright lights of London, to find work, to find friends, to find love. And then, but sadly, it's 1981, and it's the year that HIV and AIDS starts to appear on the scene. And throughout the series, which follows them through 10 years, we see how that impacts their lives in a really devastating kind of way.
Did you know when you was making it, or did you think when you was making this, that it would have the impact and people would engage with it in the way they did? Because as you said, hey, we do have a lot of ignorance, and there hasn't been much proactiveness around HIV in the UK. So did you think that that would be, because it's so, you know, HIV AIDS strong, did you think that people would engage with it in the way they have?
Do you know what really surprised me is I knew it would make waves in the LGBT community because it's Russell T Davies, like, you know, like Queer as Folk, yeah. You know, his work, and his work in Doctor Who, you know, which has a very sort of LGBTQ slant as well. You know, I knew for our community, it was going to be very special. And we took it really seriously, I think, on set, and the whole team. We wanted to make sure that we honoured these stories, you know, and showed the fun and the life and the love, as well as, you know, the tragedy of it all. But I don't think any of us really expected the impact that it would have beyond that. And one of my biggest worries was actually that it would sort of let old myths resurface. Mm. So, you know, in It's a Sin, we see people scrubbing cups, smashing them, throwing in the bin, you know, going in the shower after they've been near someone with HIV. And I was like, oh my God, I really hope that those attitudes don't come back to the surface. But the absolute opposite has been the case. And we've just seen HIV like on a national conversation, like we've never seen it before. And I think, you know, in the show, we see the Tombstone adverts, the very, very famous Tombstone adverts, which, you know, some people argue were very effective because they stopped people having sex. But other people say it filled lots of people with sexual anxiety for many, many years. But we've never had anything on a national scale to say how HIV has changed, you know, and that it's a manageable condition, that you can't pass it on if you're on effective treatment. So what It's a Sin has done is given all the amazing charities and activists like yourself, Gareth, and, you know, the hundreds of other activists across the country, this moment to just jump on that conversation and go, guys, HIV has changed and we can end it. You know, we can end new transmissions within 10 years if we work together.
Well, do you know what I thought was very smart about it, guys, is that it abides by the rules of good drama, good storytelling. So, and I'm going to have to admit to something. I've only been able to watch the first one because there's a lot of kids in my house and there's a lot of bonking in this, okay? And, you know, so, but even in the first one, the emotions, high, low. But what they did at the very start is we were introduced to the characters. We like the characters. We've empathy for the characters. It humanized HIV. Nathaniel, that's so, so important when you reflect on those adverts, you know, going back then, it dehumanized people. This is doing the opposite.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, those Tombstone adverts were just basically like, oh, if you get this thing, that's it. You're in a coffin. And there was no human element to that. And when you think about the response to coronavirus, which is a very different epidemic, and, you know, the two are not really that comparable. But when you think about the compassion that we might have seen in the advertising around that, about how to look after one another, how to protect one another, you know, sharing that information rather than scaremongering or saying that these people are dangerous. You can see how the stigma around HIV became so ingrained, and obviously it was very much also interlinked with the homophobia at the time. In the 1980s and 90s, Britain was a profoundly homophobic place. And in the press, in parliamentary life, so the two were really interlinked. And I think it is said in the final episode, it's not really a spoiler this, but in the final episode, someone says, the perfect virus came along to kind of prove you right, your homophobia right. It was like the perfect way you could weaponize that against gay men straight away. And we know, though, that HIV doesn't only affect gay men. It disproportionately affects men who have sex with men, but over 50% of people live with HIV are heterosexuals. It's incredible the power of the stigma and the shame that sort of was set in motion in the 1980s that we're still unpicking today.
I think that for me, when I watched it, because I watched it with my husband, I sat down with Steve and I watched the first episode, and then we realised, because we're not very like techie, that we could actually download all of it and watch it all at once. So I sat there and I remember I went to bed with such a mix of emotions that I kissed him and I said, I'm kissing you right now because I can. And I just realised that 40 years ago, I couldn't even be living in the same house as you, let alone kiss you. And I went to bed as somebody who didn't really face discrimination in the 80s or 90s, because even though it was there, I didn't really relate to any of it. And I went to bed and I cried. I cried and cried just because I felt I was really lucky. And now I'm questioning whether I'm lucky, because you see this obvious discrimination, as you said, the cleaning of the cups, the posting of poo through the letterbox, this locking people in rooms, this obvious discrimination from the 80s. And I feel, even though we haven't got that obvious discrimination, we still have maybe an obvious discrimination to try and deal with, which is kind of a pandemic in itself. It's something that actually can be deemed more painful. Now, I know you're living with HIV, so do you see that an obvious form of discrimination?
Yeah, I think what it is that, stigma is such a really difficult concept to kind of unpick. Unless you're stigmatized yourself, unless you feel it, unless you're in a minority, it's very hard to communicate. And I think one of the ways I try and explain it to people is how the Black Lives Matter movement has tried to help us understand racism in all its forms, in the last year. You don't need to shout a racist slur to be racist. There are structures and the ways in which our society is built that mean that some people are disadvantaged or are oppressed because of those structures. And it's the same with HIV, So, indirect discrimination that I've faced in my life, I've lived with HIV for 18 years, all my adult sexual life. It's people is saying that they won't, they choose not to go into a relationship or have sex with me because I'm HIV positive. When actually, I'm not a danger to anyone. I'm on HIV medication. I can't pass it on. And it's actually, you're actually more at risk if you choose not to have sex with me. Yeah. Because that actually, and that sometimes blows people's minds. They don't kind of understand that. And I think the other indirect...
Sorry, Nathaniel, explain that just to people listening at the moment. Explain that.
So most new transmissions of HIV come from people who don't know they've got HIV. So HIV doesn't really present with that many symptoms. When your body first recognises you've got it, you have like flu-like symptoms, but they generally pass quite quickly. And so often people don't put two and two together that they might have exposed themselves to HIV through, and that they've contracted it. So then what they might do is then, if they've not been tested and they don't know, they might go for a period of time not knowing they're HIV positive and pass it on. And that's where most new transmissions happen. So when people turn around to people like me and say, like, I'm not going to have sex with you because you're HIV positive, I'm like, well, I've given you the information. We know, and we can make sure that we do it safely. I'm on medication, which means I can't pass it on, or we could choose to use condoms. There's all different ways in which you can protect yourself. So that's one of the main things about one of the reasons why it's so important for people to get tested regularly. But I think the other sort of indirect discrimination is the slightly more subtle attitudes people might have towards you as somebody who's got HIV. So there may be, I mean, you know, Gareth, I can't imagine what it felt like to be, you know, in the position you were put in, being forced, you know, to come out in that way, because there is this idea that somehow it is a scandal. It's newsworthy gossip that somehow you are immoral, or that you have strayed from the moral norm, or, you know, or that you deserved it because you were somebody who slept around, or, you know, all of those things. And actually, when you boil it right down, it's a virus. It's no different than the common cold. It's a virus. It's just passed through sexual contact. And unfortunately, some people find it very difficult to separate their own morality around sex and sexuality and a virus, which is just something that is, you know, trying to survive and live. So though it's that subtle stigma and discrimination that I think people with HIV still face.
Guys, I watching the first one, it's a bit of a spoiler, but when Henry dies at the end, and it's so moving and it's so sad. And when he's in the room on his own and then he leaves and the nurses come in and scrub it, and I was quite judgy watching it. And then I thought about coronavirus and the way people are going around scrubbing things. And when you think the way we dealt with this disease 10 months ago to the way we do now, largely out of ignorance and fear. It was a fear of the disease, or was it a fear of the people who had it? I'm not really quite sure. I was left confused by the whole thing. But it seemed to be slow to change from the 80s when you look back at the 80s. Nathaniel, your own story, you were diagnosed in 2002, 2003, am I right?
That's right,
but,
yeah.
But you still didn't feel, you still felt it was so stigmatised, you couldn't come out with the news?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I was 16, or just so I was very, very young, you know, and I came out, you know, at 16. I met someone who was older than me. I that was probably my act of rebellion. We all have them as teenagers, don't we? And I'd had the conversation about, you know, using condoms with my mom and all that sort of stuff. And so I think there was so much shame around the work that I'd contracted it, that I found it very, very difficult to be open. You know, I was given, that was 18 years ago, I was given a prognosis. So I was given a shorter life expectancy than most other people. So it was a really traumatic event. But I sort of thought that I sort of made out to myself that it wasn't. You know, I just went, oh, this thing's happened, I'll get on with my life. And I did, and I carried on. You know, I went to college, went to university, I did everything I wanted to do. But it was eating away at me inside. And I don't know, Gareth, you might be able to kind of empathize with this, how keeping secrets like that, they impact your ability to hold down relationships. You know, I started relying on alcohol and drugs, because there was this pain, there was this sadness that I'd not dealt with. And that's when it got to a really bad point in 2017, when I said, I've got to change this. I have to say it out loud. I have to work through this trauma and this pain, because, you know, my life was just in such a bad place at that time.
Yeah, life becomes really difficult, because I think what you do as well, see, is you harbour this secret because you feel like you're protecting everybody else, but also kind of protecting yourself. But that means that you live in fear. So you live in fear of people finding out. So if I went to stay at my mate's with a family, I live in fear of maybe someone going in my toilet bag and finding this tablet and questioning why I have this tablet. Or I live in fear of kind of doing something, or not wanting to do something that I thought could potentially put other people at risk. And I think when you live in fear, you kind of you lose control, because you're lying, you're living in fear, and you feel like you're kind of, whatever you're destined to be, whatever you're destined to do, you're basically holding back on it, because you can't be authentic in any way, shape, in any way, shape or form. So it harbours a massive amount of pressure on how you live your daily life, and almost to a point is where I think you've kind of become kind of reclusive. You know, I was unsure that I couldn't pass it on, so I didn't really want to have a partner, because I thought, if I tell somebody, I give somebody the information, that makes me vulnerable to them. So you become very much recluse, because it all of a sudden becomes about kind of protecting yourself. But by protecting yourself, you're protecting yourself from others as well.
What was your fear, Nathaniel?
I think, yeah, it's a similar sort of thing. It's like it becomes a very isolating experience, like Gareth just said. You know, I think what I did is that I stupidly was like, didn't want to talk to anyone about it. You know, I mean, my partners knew, of course, and a few friends knew, but, you know, people were like, oh, why don't you go, you know, go to like George House Trust, which is the local HIV charity, and meet other people, you know, and chat. And I was like, nah, you know, I don't want to sit around in a circle and chat about my problems with people. That's not for me, you know, and all this sort of stuff and this. But actually, over time, like Gareth says, I just became so isolated with it. And my relationships with people closest to me became strained, because the more and more you hold this thing away, this truthful part of you away, and you hide it, the more you become distant. So, you know, my relationship, my parents became strained, you know, the relationships that I was in, you know, I was in a really toxic relationship with two people who had not dealt with traumas from their past, and we were playing those traumas out on each other, you know, and it was unfair on both of us. So yeah, it became a very isolating experience. And I think what I realized in 2017 is that because I wasn't saying this thing out loud, I actually believed the narrative that I hated so much. And the narrative I hate is when people say it's something to be ashamed of, because it's not. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's just something I live with. And I sort of was like, oh my God, by not saying it, I'm self-stigmatizing. I'm putting that narrative on myself. And that's when I just changed. I decided to change the narrative and go, I'm going to say it. I mean, I did it pretty publicly. You know, I'm not saying that everyone needs to, you know, sit on the BBC breakfast couch with Charlie and Naga, or, you know, I was at one point trending higher than Jennifer Aniston's bangs on BuzzFeed. You know, I'm not saying everyone needs to go that far, but I think I felt, you know, I'm white, I'm middle class, I'm, you know, I'm a cisgendered man. I have loads of privilege in this world. And so actually I went, do you know what? I can say this, and hopefully I can make a world, or start to help to make a world, that where it's safer for other people, and for other people to feel more comfortable and confident to say the HIV positive, because actually it's more treatable. It's easier to treat than diabetes, you know? So I really just wanted to start to change that narrative. And hopefully, you know, I think in the last 2-3 years, we've really seen a shift in how people are thinking about HIV.
Can I put this to both of you to discuss the fear you both had and the reality then when you actually did tell everyone? Talk to us about that.
I think you create this fear as well, because it justifies why you lie to everybody. You have to have some sort of justification, and I think because I was blackmailed because of this information, because I had this press, then actually that justified why you felt so wrong. Because nobody blackmails you to tell you, you give me 250 grand, or I'm going to tell everyone you're brilliant. It's like, well, go and tell everyone I'm brilliant, you know, or, you know, we're going to print this story about you being fantastic. So you don't, you know,
Sorry, how much will that cost?
more than 250 grand for me, let me tell you. So I think other forces had played part in confirming why I shouldn't tell anyone, because, you know, they blackmail, or the fear of the press going to the story to write a negative story about me wasn't something I wanted. But I feel, you know what I feel the reality was? I don't know if Nathaniel felt this, was that when I was publicly honest about who I was getting waves of support from people in the LGBTQ+ community, because they kind of had understood and had an empathy with HIV, because we're more at risk characteristic. But also what I found was that people who have never had or may never have relevance to HIV understood somebody who has been put in a position of vulnerability and has decided to say, screw you. Like, I am taking control of my own life. I am taking control of my own story, and I'm telling it my way. And I choose to do it in a way that's empowering to other people, that's positive to the community of people that I'm representing, but also positive to the community in general. And I found by doing it that way, regardless whatever my narrative was, people engaged in it in that way. And, you know, I don't know about Nathaniel, but for me, if I want a friend, then one of the values I look for in a friend is honesty. If that person tells me something I don't like, I'm still going to respect him and like him because he's decided to be honest with me. And I felt that's what I found people engage with most.
Yeah, absolutely. I all of everything you've said just resonates so much. And I think that, you know, your decision to you know, it's awful that you were forcing that into that position, but your decision to go, no, this is my information, this is my life, my story, I'm going to own it, I'm going to tell it. And that authenticity just resonates so much with people. And also, I think what happened in that moment is you really exposed, you know, the gutter press for what they are. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So it was like, it was, you know, you kill two birds with one stone in a sense, because it was absolutely just so atrocious. And I couldn't believe, you know, I watched almost with horror at that happening. And I just thought, is this where we're at, you know, with the press still? You know, for me, absolutely the same, you know, becoming authentic. Up until the point, I told my family in 2017, and then I made my solo show first time in 2018, and that's when I sort of told the world. Up until that point, you know, my life had sort of just bubbled along. I'd sort of just got by, you know. I'd had some success as an actor, you know, little bits here and there. You know, I was kind of just getting by, but actually it never really gone in the direction that I'd hoped it had. And I realized it was because I wasn't living authentically. And it was also interlinked to my identity as a gay man, you know, and never navigating the acting world. The arts industry, although it's run by gay people, is actually still quite a homophobic environment. So, you know, I was told to sort of reduce, you know, hide my gayness or tone it down, you know, for different things. And in 2017, I just went, no, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm bored of reducing who I am or making myself smaller or less, because I don't want people to choose me or have me in their life if it's not the real me. So, you know, the minute I went, this is who I am, you know, warts and all, and also my show doesn't necessarily paint me as the hero, believe me. You know, it's complicated, it's messy. But the minute I did that, all the right people stood up and took notice. You know, I was asked to audition for It's a Sin because the producer of the show had seen my show. So the minute I started telling authentic stories was the minute, you know, the magic happened and continues to happen. You know, I'm sat here chatting with you two. What an amazing opportunity, you know, for a kid from Stockport who, age 16, you know, got this diagnosis and thought his life was over, in a sense.
It's amazing, isn't it? If you're not true to yourself, you cannot reach all those things you're capable of reaching. But I mean, it's a very similar story for you, Gareth. I still, Nathaniel, I'm still baffled at how Gareth achieved all he did in his rugby career. With carrying around this burden, I don't know, and I wonder sometimes. Do you think if you had been more open earlier, could you have achieved more? Would it have been different for you?
Listen, I think, and maybe Nathaniel, I'm assuming, thinks the same. As I'd like to be able to have the hindsight to go back and manipulate and change things, but I know I never can. So I don't kind of waste the energy thinking about them. All I do, like Nathaniel does, is I put my energy now into making sure people have the environments where they don't have to make that decision anymore. Because I always think about moments in my life where I was so focused and the main priority was like hiding my sexuality, or the main priority was hiding my HIV diagnosis, that for days, weeks, months, years, I never actually fucking lived. I just survived. I just got along. And I wonder what I could have done in them years of being lived. And there's no way that I can stop ever wondering about that. But I think what's so great about when you become a part of a community, or become a part of a characteristic that people feel like they can prejudice against, is you really want to fight to make sure you do your best to stop that prejudice happening to other people. And I think that's, you know, this is the first time I know of Nathaniel, obviously, but this is the first time I've spoken to him. And I feel like this real synergy of two people who have been through the mill and are not bitter about being through the mill, but are passionate about making sure that other people don't go through that same mill and it never exists for other people anymore.
Yeah, I think the thing you can do with your life. I mean, we all face trauma in our lives. Like, you know, that's just part of being human, isn't it? You know, we're always going to love and lose people we love, and we're all going to face ill health at different points in our lives, and things are going to happen to us. And one of the things that you know, my mum is very good at drilling this into me is it's like you can either become a victim in the story of your life, or you can become the hero in the story of your life. And, you know, and it's hard. It's really hard sometimes because you do have days where you wallow in your own self-pity. Believe me, you know, like I come across in interviews, people always send me messages on Instagram or Twitter. They're like, God, you're always so happy and so smiley. I'm like, yeah, on camera, of course I am. You know, when I'm chatting to Lorraine, I'm of course I'm going to be smiley because it's Lorraine Kelly.
It's Lorraine. A legend. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But of course, I still have all those demons, you know, behind closed doors. You know, those things still happen and you have to look after yourself. Yeah, I think it's about... When you break through, manage to break through, like if you manage to come out, you know, if you're lesbian, gay, bisexual, or trans, or you know, or you something like living with HIV, and you start to live authentically, and you get across that challenge, it opens up a world of possibilities. But in a similar way to what Gareth's saying, I don't look back at my past self and go, you know, and beat myself up about the things that happened or the things that I did, because, you know, those things, both good and bad, have built who I am today. And it's just part of, you know, the story of your own life, isn't it?
Look, thankfully, we know so much more about HIV from those awful days back in the 80s. And medicines got better, treatments got better. You cannot pass it on through sexual contact. We know that. You can live a very happy, long life. But do you both still have, because it's an enormous sentence, I have HIV. It's still a big sentence. Do you still have moments of fear with that?
Ooh. yeah, I think, you know, it's changed dramatically in the 18 years that I've lived with HIV. When I was first diagnosed, you weren't put onto medication straight away. So I lived about 8 years without medication. And I had to live with the knowledge that I was, and I hate saying this and put it in inverted commas, I was infectious. You know, I could pass it on. I had a long-term partner at the time. We used condoms. Thankfully, he remained negative. But there was always this anxiety around sex, which was really, really hard thing to carry. And then when we found out about, you know, undetectable equals untransmittable, and it's scientifically proven that I can't pass it on, and then also we now know about PrEP as well, pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is the drugs that people can take preemptively. So my new partner, he is on PrEP and I'm on medication, so, you know, belt and braces, were really both protected. So loads of that anxiety is gone. But yeah, sometimes you do have days where it hits you. You know, sometimes I look in the drawer, which is just to my left, which has got my HIV medication in, and I go, if that medication wasn't there, if that was taken away, that, you know, I'm going to get sick. Yeah. So, you know, I know there was all sorts of worries around Brexit and medications not being available and, you know, then potentially being taken away. So although we're so blessed and so lucky, we have the NHS and we have the healthcare provided, you know, there is that sense of, if that's taken away, that's it for you. So you do live knowing that there is something inside you that is lethal. And that's quite a lot to carry. And that's something that comes up quite a lot in my therapy sessions with my therapist.
Yeah, but also I think the thing, I actually think, so for me, like Nathaniel, I went from having a secret that I wanted no one to know about to all of a sudden having this thing of openness that is still very personal to me. You like allowing people into your personal life, even though they have no need to know about your personal life at all. So it can become quite invasive. And therefore, when something becomes invasive or you feel vulnerable, you kind of assess situations. So you assume everybody knows, but you never assume that everybody's okay with it. So you can walk into environments where all of a sudden you're almost like a vulnerable sitting target. And you feel, why should I have to walk around feeling vulnerable? But for me, and I think this comes from a more of a sporting element, for me, fear is also one of my biggest motivations, my biggest drives, because if I'm fearful of it, then I realise that we still have work to do. We still have things to do. Nathaniel needs to keep going on Lorraine show. And people need to be speaking on public platforms to stop the fear, to negate the fear. And so for me, it's very much a source of motivation. It's not something I continue to want to have. It's something I strive to never have. But it is a motivation to understand that I still have to. And I don't know about you, sometimes now, especially since this program, like, do you feel you have to assess environments sometimes?
Do you know what? I've not been anywhere, Gareth, because of the bloody lockdown.
Of course.
I've only been one place, which is the supermarket. And do you know what? No one's recognised me yet because we're all wearing face masks. But I know some of the other cast members just can't walk down the street without being recognised. Bless them. Do you know what? The biggest thing actually was when I made my solo show first time, and there was a huge, in 2018, there was this huge whirlwind of media around it. It was shared globally. It was all over the world. And I did these four shows. And then the week after, you know, took a week off. I was exhausted, you know, or just trying to recover. And then I went to get my hair cut at the barber's. And that's quite a macho environment, you know. And sometimes lots of, you know, gay men, sometimes we feel uncomfortable in certain environments. You know, I don't walk into a working men's club and instantly feel welcome. And I know often that is sometimes just my own internalized preconceptions of what those people are going to think. But I was in the barber's chair and he asked me what I did. And I almost sort of just glossed over it. And then I went, no, you've just done all this stuff. You've just stood up on stage and said, you're HIV positive. You've just said that you've got to break down the stigma. And I was like, this is the coal face of breaking down people's attitudes. And so I just went for it and just said, you know, I'm HIV positive. I've just made this show about it. Google me. You'll find me on BuzzFeed. You know, it was like, and it was this huge shift and moment where I went, I need to live what I preach, in a sense. But yeah, it is hard, and some days you do just want to blend into the background, you know, and just, you know, have an easy life. So it's a real balancing act, I think.
Thank you both, by the way, for sharing that with everybody, because that's a very personal thing to share. I think everyone really appreciate that. We appreciate the work you're doing, both of you, and you have to continue it. I want to give you these numbers, and I'm hoping they're changing with It's a Sin Show going out. Last year, there was a Tackle HIV survey of 4,000 people. Here are the headlines. 61% of people said that if they found out a potential partner was HIV positive, they would or might end the relationship. Almost half, 49% of people think HIV can still be passed on even if the person is on effective treatment. We know it can't be, okay? More than one in three people, 34%, said they would not play a contact sport if they knew one of their opponents had HIV. Both of you, with all the work you're doing and have done in the past, how do you feel about the future when you hear those kind of numbers?
I think for me, it's the reality of the world we live in. I think that, you know, I can't sit here, Nathaniel can't sit there, because we both know that is the case, because I know I have, I'm sure Nathaniel have lived experiences of coming across people like that. But I get what that does for me, and I'd like to think it does the same for Nathaniel. He can speak in what he says now, is it means that what I'm doing, what you're doing, what the show is doing, is needed and is relevant. Even though the show was based in the 80s, the relevance of what it does to people living in 2021 is still hugely important.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does sometimes, when I see surveys like that, and it does surprise me that those attitudes are still out there. And I think the thing that I've done as I've grown, and, you know, I've lived with HIV for more of my life, I've been HIV positive than I haven't. And I've learned that there is a level to how much I can educate people. And it's not my responsibility either. Do you know what I mean? You know, I used to tell prospective partners I was HIV positive, you know, and they'd sort of reject me or say, you know, all this sort of stuff. And then I try and educate them. And I'm like, do you know what? I'm not going to waste my breath anymore. Mm. The information is out there. Go out and do the education yourself. You know, go and get tested regularly, because it's not just, you know, it's not just my responsibility to end HIV. So as I've got older, I've relaxed a little bit more. I know those attitudes are out there. And what I try and do is spread a positive and joyful message and surround myself with the people that support that. And if people choose to direct hate or negativity towards that, I just tell them where to go. Good man.
Nathaniel, it's been absolutely brilliant. It's been great talking to him, hasn't it?
It's been brilliant. Yeah, so good. Thank you.
Not often that someone's personality, it matches their wallpaper. So fair play. Like, that's some effort. Look, really good talking to you. And just, look, keep up all the good work. And you know, you're doing a fine job. And it's just really, really interesting to have someone coming on and being so honest and sharing everything, because every bit helps. Any message before you go to the people listening to this podcast?
Get tested. That's it. You order a test, freetesting.hiv. If you're sexually active, every 6 to 12 months, get yourself a HIV test. It's a little finger prick test you do at home. You find out very, very quickly. And then if you get a positive result, you're going to get amazing healthcare. You're going to be fine, happy and healthy. But it means that you're protecting yourself and you're protecting your partners. And then hopefully by 2030, we'll have ended all new transmissions of HIV.
There you go.
Simple.
Nathaniel, I can hear a dog that needs to be walked in the background.
Yes, that is my dog.
You better go do that. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Nathaniel, mate. Thank you, Bert. You're a ledge. Thank you, man.